Hey, if you're enjoying this show, consider supporting us on our Patreon. You can get cool perks like access to these episodes a week before they go public, and you can pick an album for us to review. Any support is greatly appreciated, so if you feel inclined, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.
You're listening to Polyphonic Press, a podcast for music lovers. Join your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke, as they take a deep dive into a classic album and analyze it track by track.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And I don't know what to say.
Shabadoo.
I don't know. Actually, I hadn't thought this far ahead. I don't know what to say.
Well, we just get everything working, and then suddenly, oh wait, there's also supposed to be for the talking and the thing.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, I guess we don't want to waste too much time, so. So I guess we'll just go right ahead and pick what album we're going to be listening to this week.
Yep. Okay.
So let's spin the wheel, roll the dice, and all the things. I don't know. And okay, let's pick
the
album.
Kick the dumpster.
Kick the dumpster. Okay. And bam. We're going to be listening to Aretha Franklin's Lady Soul.
Mm.
So I don't know much about Aretha Franklin.
You know a little bit.
Okay, so this is her 12th studio album, released in January of 1968. Couple of singles from the album is You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, Chain of Fools. I know that song.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet Baby, Since You've Been Gone. Yeah, cool. I'm excited to get into this. I don't really know much about Aretha Franklin or not that familiar with her music.
I've heard quite a bit of stuff. I don't think I've had the full album placed in front of me, oddly enough. But yeah, her stuff has definitely popped up over the years at my house. So
cool. Get into it. The first song on the album is Chain of Fools.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to...
It's a good one. I like it.
Okay, so let's get into that. Chain of Fools. Awesome.
Yep.
That was, she has such an amazing voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those voices where it has so much feeling in it. You know what I mean? And the playing on that song was great. I mean, this is in the 60s when you didn't have, synthesizers or drum machines or anything like that. And I noticed at one point there was a bit of a mistake where I think it was the keyboard player, one of the piano players, actually missed a beat. And, you know, if that had happened today, you would have edited that out. But it's kind of amazing that they left that in.
Yeah, well, I think that track was awesome. There's nothing, I mean, nothing's really noticeable that stands out. I think that little mistake you're talking about with the piano, I didn't notice that myself, but I noticed little other things going. There was nothing really there's no real flaws to, you know, that are really like, they don't damage it or in any capacity.
No. I mean, I'm not saying that it was a bad thing or anything like that. It's just, and it was barely noticeable. But I was just like, you can tell that this was probably recorded live, like with all the players in the same room.
Live off the floor, I'm quite certain. And I just love the sound. There's so much bottom end on that.
Yeah.
Even the guitar is like really low down there. It might have even been like a, what do they call them? a baritone guitar, although I don't know how many baritone guitars are being made at the time, but
it might have just been tuned a step down.
Oh yeah, it might have been.
So actually the guitar players on this album, it doesn't say which tracks they play on. Well, I can actually see. So the guitars were on this track were done by Jimmy Johnson and Joe South.
Mm-hmm.
Who Joe South is a really good singer songwriter in his own right.
Yep.
But on the album credits, Eric Clapton plays guitar at some point as well.
Mm.
And you're right. Like the sound, it's just that 60s, like Phil Spector had that kind of sound as well. And it's just like that 60s pop R&B soul sound, like that Stax sound or that Motown sound. There's just something about it that sounds so good that other records of the time don't really sound like that.
Yeah, it's funny. There's only like a few places where you would get that sound out of it, but no, it's not a sound that you would get out of like most rock bands of the time or something like that. I mean, many of them were trying to sort of mimic a sound similar like that. Actually, they were listening to stuff that was even older than that while this stuff was being produced.
Yeah.
I just love that. Really, it almost sounds like, I don't want to say it sounds like out of date or anything like that, but it sounds very much like an early 60s or a mid 60s thing, even though this is like 1968. But I guess it's just because that sound, like they never stopped doing that sound. Stax and Motown, stuff like that. They sort of carried that. It evolved a little bit, but that's just sort of what they went with, and everything else is like evolving, like, crazy rates around them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's not to knock this at all.
No.
I love it. I love the sound. It's one of my favorite tracks, actually.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you're saying, because in the rock, I can only speak for myself, but I think you're the same. As my view of the 60s is informed by the evolution of rock bands.
Yeah.
Which changed rapidly, like from the sort of bluesy, like Yardbirds kind of early Rolling Stones thing to the more psychedelic stuff, and then sort of getting back to the bluesy rock towards the end of the 60s. But still, with the experience of the psychedelic stuff. So you can very clearly see the evolution of rock and roll through that. But on the other side, you have like stuff like this, the Memphis sound and the Motown and stuff. It didn't change quite as rapidly. And maybe actually it changed more of a natural progression.
Mm, yeah, less of an injection of acid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I'm sure there was a little bit of that around.
Yeah. Because it's weird to think about, like, 65 is only 2 years before 1967, but they seem like worlds apart.
Yep. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, you can find anything in 1965 that sounded even remotely psychedelic, really. I mean, there was like proto-punk and stuff like that, mm-hmm. like around at the time. But again, it's that whole really, strange noises and playing with warbling and things like that, and talk box, or not talk boxes, but wah-wah pedals and stuff like that. I mean, none of that would exist in 1965, and then around 1967, you could hardly get away from it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Whereas before, like, a change like that would take place over 5 years or something.
Yeah.
That was 2 years.
Yep.
And it still blows my mind that how much things changed like that. But it is perhaps, like, the more natural the way that soul music changed. And maybe I don't know. Obviously acid was a huge influence in the rock scene. I don't think it was as much of an influence in the pop and R&B scene. Obviously, which you know, acid is going to change everything, and we could get a whole into a whole discussion about the way psychedelics change your brain and maybe how it changed the collective consciousness and all that. But this is not that episode.
No.
So let's listen to the next track, which is called Money Won't Change You. Man, I just love the way that it grooves. Like the way that it just feels like really laid back and relaxed.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, energetic yet relaxed.
Yeah.
In a way, yeah. It's an energetic, but it's an easily moving energetic. Yeah. It feels like it doesn't take much energy to gain that much energy. It's interesting.
I envision like a train going down the tracks. It's just once it gets the momentum, it just goes, and it's just going really easy. Just
the weight of the train is pushing it along. Yeah,
yeah. And it's just one of those, like the way the drums are playing just a little bit behind the beat, which is a very it's a very much a sign of the times in these players. And actually, I'm wondering who actually played on this. So it's either Roger Hawkins or Gene Chrisman. I don't know who those guys are, but I'm sure they're the studio musicians who
Roger Hawkins. Played on. I think I've heard of Roger Hawkins, possibly. Again, some of these musicians, they turn up in other sessions and stuff like that. And you might read their names and on all sorts of things around there, but I'm sure they were like known to people in these studios for sure.
Yeah. And the bass line was doubled with the piano. Then I noticed that was a really interesting technique that they did as well. And just to kind of fill the space, and Jerry Wexler is the producer on this. And apparently he produced a whole bunch of these, soul and R&B. He's done a lot, even in the rock stuff. But yeah, he's an amazing producer, and it really takes talent to. I am amazed at the way that these records turned out. In the way, because I went when I was studying audio engineering, we did all of our stuff on computers, and it's amazing to me how they mixed everything without seeing the waveform. They actually had to listen.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, honestly, the waveform, well, when I look at the waveform, like all it tells me for anything is if something is clipping, but usually you can hear that.
Yeah.
So honestly, I don't pay that close attention to the waveform when I'm, you know, working on stuff like this personally. So that's just me. I guess I'm more analog that way.
Yeah. But you have to, even when you're making an edit, I mean, if you're cutting tape and editing two takes together or something, you, especially if it's like a full mix, like if it's drums, you have to get it right exactly where the beat starts, and you have to listen for it. And scrub the two reels of tape back and forth to where you get it exactly, and then make the cut. And I'm just amazed at that skill. And I guess you would get used to it after a while. You would just do it without even really thinking about it.
Basically, it would be, they'd be using your ears, their ears, the way you'd be using your eyes.
Exactly.
When editing. So
yeah.
The way you can visualize the waveform on it, their brain is visualizing it, but through the ears, as opposed to registering the information through the eyes.
Exactly.
So it's just a skill you would develop after a while.
Yeah. I'm just amazed that they didn't have any other way to do it.
Nope.
Back then either. So it's like, well, this is how you do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. So let's listen to the next one. It's called People Get Ready, and I think I know this song. That song, Money Won't Change You, is actually originally done by James Brown. That's a cover from James Brown. So next one is People Get Ready. Let's hear that.
People get ready, there's a train coming. Don't need no baggage, you just get
what an amazing voice.
Yeah.
Man, I'm always I can't really sing, and I'm always amazed at people who can control their voice that way. I don't know how they do it.
I mean, I was in choirs a bit when I was younger. I can't sing like Aretha can.
No.
I mean, it's just because my voice can't do some of the things that she can, but I can carry a note. But yeah, no. My range isn't like that. And actually, I think it's been it's gone down since the years. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it's like anything. You have to practice at it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I've been told
maybe I can get it back.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you can. I've been told that anybody can learn to sing. People think that it's a talent.
There is, I mean, there's a certain amount of talent to it, it can be learned. I mean, learning to hear that note, it is a skill that you can learn.
Yeah. I mean, obviously some people's voices just won't do that. Yeah. They're just physically not built to do that.
Yeah.
But anybody can learn to sing and hit the notes. Really what I've learned what has made me a better singer is learning to control your breathing. And so on that track, I noticed the guitar, and I'm pretty sure that's Eric Clapton playing guitar.
Could be.
It sounds a lot like him. Mm-hmm. And he's one of those guitar players that you hear and you know that it's him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a very unique guitar sound. Well, I guess we'll move on to the next track then.
All right. So the next one is called Nikki Hokey. Interesting title. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That was a cool song. I like the call and response of the her and the background singers.
Yeah. That sounded almost like a Tony Joe White sort of song. That one.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
Like Poke Salad Annie or something.
It sounds, yeah, it's definitely in that vein.
Did they maybe rip him off or something?
I don't think so. I'm sure he got a lot of influence from stuff like this, actually.
Yeah, because this came out in 68, and that Tony Joe Waite, 69.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
Or maybe released June 69. Yeah. So maybe he heard this, and I've done that before. I've picked up on things from another song and came up with something that's based on that.
Yep.
Yeah, that was a fun song. I mean, just I don't know if it fits on the album.
No, I think it's all right. It sort of fits in with the Chain of Fools sound and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true. This one was a little bit faster, I thought.
Yeah, but that's fine. I mean, a good, well-rounded album has got songs of all sorts of different speeds and lengths and things. Have you heard the Tony Joe White album that was just released recently? That it was like the last thing he'd recorded before he died, but it was with Dan Auerbach.
No.
No? It's pretty good. It's good stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
No, I haven't heard that. I know he did something with Foo Fighters.
Hmm. Could
before,
be.
But, I'll have to check that out.
This album just came out. I mean, he died like, I think he might have been one of the people who died around 2016 at time. But the album was just put out either just this past year or the year before or something like that. It's pretty recent.
Cool. All right. Well, let's get on to the next song here. It's called "You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman." I know this song.
Everybody knows this song.
Everyone knows this song.
We think.
Yeah. If you don't.
I mean, we don't mean to assume, but it is a very well-known song.
Yes, exactly. All right, here we go. One of the things that I noticed about that that was really stood out to me was the way that the when they sang the chorus, all the music dropped out except for the bass. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really cool, the way that the bass kind of doubled the heart or the melody of the chorus, and then everything came back in again, which is it's something that's very unique to that time.
Oh, dynamics have almost completely died out. So, there's only a few artists who still know how to use them properly. But yeah, production-wise, it's very rare to find a producer that'll allow real dynamics to happen on their production.
And to leave space.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, let the track breathe a little bit. And it's okay that, you know, not every instrument has to play all at the same time.
No.
And you don't have to, what they call brick wall compressing, which is just, you know, the loudness war and all that.
And it's interesting because this one even has a orchestra parts in it, which is like something that people, you know, associate with like overproduction. But honestly, I actually really like the parts that they put in there. Like the orchestra parts are just, they're perfect. They're not all over the place. They're honestly just little accents, little cherries on top of an already great track. And it doesn't hurt it. It actually enhances it in just the right places.
Exactly. It's what synthesizers were meant to do.
Yes.
You know, I think getting into like 80s production where the synthesizer was front and center in a lot of tracks, where I think it's okay to use, I'm not a huge fan of that sound. Some of it is okay.
I've heard it used properly. I mean, yeah, it's about how it's used. You can use it, and it's grown on me over the years.
Yeah, I've learned to appreciate it, but it's not my favorite sound.
No.
And it can, like, if I listen to too much of it, it can get kind of boring, honestly.
Yeah, it can grate on you.
But where I think it's used well is when it's used like this in a background to just lift the track up a little bit.
Sort of like punctuation in places as opposed to carrying absolutely everything, especially when every instrument is actually being replicated on a DX7. It's annoying.
Yeah.
Yep.
So this track was co-written with Carole King, and if you don't know who Carole King is, she wrote a lot of pop music from the 60s for everyone from The Animals to this track. She wrote so many songs, and she's also a really good singer-songwriter. Had a career afterward as a singer-songwriter in the 70s.
Yep. She's one of those people who you don't realize how old she is until you start looking into her history. It's just like, wait, she was doing stuff way back in the late 50s and 60s? Good grief, how old was she?
Yeah.
She was young when she started.
She was very young when she started. She's 79 now.
Yeah.
And I know that because I'm on her Wikipedia page.
There you go,
I didn't just know that offhand.
Yeah.
I know she wrote that song "Don't Bring Me Down" by The Animals.
Oh, she wrote that one.
She She wrote how many? What other song? "You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman." She wrote "The Locomotion." I didn't know that.
Okay. Actually, I think I did know that one. I heard that one. Yeah.
But she wrote a lot of pop music from the 60s, including this song. What I was going to say is the reason that the strings are on this track, and they did this a lot with a lot of soul music in the day. It's not exactly the best thing. It's they would add strings so that it would be played on white radio.
Yes, I know. Oh, it's true. And it's funny. We're going back and we're talking about how we're used to like the rock and roll of the era, but listening to like the soul and the Motown stuff, that was rock and roll.
It's
categorized it to sort of, again, segregate in quotations, white music and black music, because they could not get their heads around the fact that they're doing the same thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, earlier on in the 50s, and you think about like rock and roll, who do you think about? You think about Chuck Berry, yeah. Fats Domino,
yep.
People like that.
But also people coming along like Buddy Holly and, of course, Elvis and yeah. people like that.
But so it was more integrated in the 50s. Mm-hmm.
But they had to separate it when the 60s rolled around.
Yeah. And then going from there, I think it did more damage than it in the long term than it did more good, because rock now is seen as a white person's music.
Yeah. It's true.
And there's only a handful of black artists that I would consider rock,
mm-hmm.
or that is considered rock.
Or even rock adjacent. A lot of them are very, steeped in the blues and stuff like that, which is,
yeah.
that's not a problem. I honestly wish more white rock was, they could learn a lot more from the blues as well as the Beatles.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But I think of like, from this period on, I think Jimi Hendrix, I can really only think of one person per decade. I think like there's Jimi Hendrix from the 60s, Phil Lynott from Thin Lizzy in the 70s.
I can think of a few more. There's Arthur Lee of Love from the 60s,
right.
late 60s into the 70s. But I think that his most well-known stuff is the 60s. Man, I really hope we get to do Forever Changes. I hope that's in the... That's such a good album.
If not, we can add it.
Yeah, I'm sure it's in there.
Yeah. And then in the 80s, I guess Lenny Kravitz.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 90s is him. And then the
I would actually place him more in the 90s, although he started it around in the 80s, but his most well-known stuff is in the 90s.
Yeah, fair enough. And then there's the guy from Hootie and the Blowfish, I guess.
But again, there are more. Trying to sit and think of them. I know they're out there. Now I would say Gary Clark Jr. Although again, he's more blues, but
yeah.
he's I'd put him in a rock category. I'd play him with rock stuff.
Yeah, totally. I would too. I mean, the rock and blues is like
it's always they've always been very tight
links. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it's the getting back to this is the reason that I think the reason that this was such a big hit is because of those strings. Because of those strings, it was allowed to be played on white radio,
mm-hmm.
Which is unfortunate that that's what they had to do, but like they made it work and it doesn't sound bad. But it's just unfortunate that was kind of an obligation if you wanted to release a single and have it do anything.
Yeah.
But seems times have changed in that regard, hopefully.
Yes. I guess we'll move on to the next track.
Move on to the next track. So this is the beginning of side two. This is called Sweet Sweet Baby. In brackets or parentheses for you Americans, since you've been gone. This here. Cool, that was a little more lively.
Yeah. I always have to remind myself, just, when I think about, if I'm going to do music and stuff like that, I'm thinking of all these different instruments, I want to do it. And I got to remind myself that just a regular upright piano can sometimes be a really important instrument when it comes to doing like a really driving boogie sort of sound.
Yeah.
It just sounds so great. Especially when you got like a funky bass line dancing around it and this piano. That was a very piano driven at times, when it's not bass driven, you know. This album is very bass driven. I've noticed that.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, the bass and the drums are very much in the forefront, and I think that's really, I mean, that's how you get people dancing, and then that's the way you do it. That's probably why those are mixed so high. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you think about the piano now and the way that it's used in music, it's mostly used for like slower songs and ballads and stuff like that. But when it's used on a track like this, it can really, really bring it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was barely any guitar in that track at all. I think it was just like something like a little bit of a highlight here and there, just in the background.
But but the guitar wasn't missing. Like I didn't feel like the guitar.
No, it didn't feel like it was. It was like, you know, oh, there's a gap there. No, there's no gap. It was just a really good track.
Yeah, and it's all right. So let's move on to the next track, I guess. So this song is called "Good to Me as I Am to You." I can just picture her singing that song in like a smoky lounge at like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. Usually with a little less production behind it, but yeah. It was a really good song. And again, you could really hear the piano and coming out of that one. That was a slower one, but it was still an energetic use of an upright piano.
Yeah.
It's just really good sound.
Yeah, I think that actually might be my favorite song on the album so far.
I think it's going to be hard to top the very first one. I love the Chain of Fools. That's a great song.
Yeah, no, that is a great song. But this might be, I don't know. I don't want to rank the songs, but
yeah, it's hard to rank the songs, especially when you're going through them like the first time, at least first time through an album setting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so far, this is the one that stood out to me the most as my...
it's your highlight.
This is my highlight, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And it's just the... Like you said, it's slow, but it has energy.
Yeah.
And I really like that about it. Which is hard to pull that off. And again, it comes down to dynamics. It's... Mm-hmm. You think of a song that is full of energy, you think that it's going to
be fast.
And you think of a slow song that it's going to be like a ballad and very delicate and thing, but it's hard to, I wouldn't say it's hard, but it takes it to a whole other level when it's a slow song that has this much balls, I guess.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. That's a ballad done right.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, yeah, this definitely is a highlight for me, for sure.
Yeah, only a few tracks left.
Yep. So, yeah, we got 3 tracks left. So the next one is called "Come Back, Baby."
That is one killer rhythm section. Wow.
Yeah. They're so tight. Just so tight. But you can tell that these guys are just so in tune with each other, and they can just play off of each other really,
mm-hmm.
really well. So you're the expert. Was that a Farfisa or a Vox Continental?
In the background, actually, I think that was I believe that was a Hammond. I believe that was a B.
Really?
But it was really high in the register, and it was really, really far back in the mix. But yeah, that's a B.
Okay.
Yeah, and you can only really hear it at the beginning, and it got really buried by the time the song was going on. But
yeah.
Again, it just added that flavor at the beginning. But yeah, I know where you're getting that sort of Vox sort of thing. It didn't quite have that sound, but it was doing its part sort of in the track, being such a high higher register sort of flavors mixed in with, of course, the real bottom end with your bass and drums, which are just so high in the mix.
And what I liked about it is it gave the track a little bit more energy.
Mm-hmm.
It just added that little bit of flavor. It's like adding some...
A little bit of tension.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just adding a little bit of pepper on the dish to give that little...
Just that sizzle.
Is that sizzle. Exactly.
Sizzle.
Yes. That's exactly what it is. Very cool. Very cool. This is an Aretha Franklin album, and we're talking mostly about the music.
Where we come from. I mean, we could go on and on and on about her voice, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, being from like a musician's or even just a rock and roll appreciator's view upon this sort of thing, we're definitely going to be looking at the music being going on behind. It really is an important part of the mix.
Yeah.
And I find it sort of a shame it doesn't get doesn't get talked about more when it comes to this. I mean, not to knock Aretha at all. I mean, who would do that?
Right.
But yeah, there's a lot going on behind her too. So,
so this is interesting. So the background singers, is a group called Sweet Inspirations.
Mm-hmm.
And it features the leader of Sweet Inspirations is Sissy Houston, okay. Whitney Houston's mother.
Yes.
I didn't know that. I didn't know Whitney Houston's mother was the singer.
I had heard. It's not something I thought much about, but I think I had heard at that one point. And I had heard that Whitney Houston's mother was a Sissy Houston, and she used to sing with people. But yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all, honestly.
Yeah. That's really cool. I didn't know that.
Yep.
But that's who's credited as the all the background singers as Sweet Inspirations. I never heard of them. I guess they're a group on their own. They're not just backup singers. This is the second last song on the album. It's called Groovin'. I think I know this song. But maybe
this isn't the same song as what is it? The Young Rascals did. I don't think it is.
It might be.
I don't think it is, but we'll see. Well, that certainly was the song I was thinking.
It was.
It wasn't. It's such a different version of it, though.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, me too.
It has a little more. It was a little more lively. I don't know what the word is, but it's
more soulful.
Yeah.
You almost feel like, well, duh. But yeah.
Yeah.
But yes, totally.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a testament to her ability to sing anything, really. This is an interesting choice of a song as well to put on the album, because you wouldn't think that Aretha Franklin doing a song by the Young Rascals would work, and yet
did they write it?
They did. Well, I don't know if they wrote it. They were the original artist.
They were the original artist. So there you go. Okay. I see. Sometimes I'm not 100% sure who came first for some of this stuff.
I know. Especially in the 60s, like...
There's a lot of songs got thrown around.
They're not necessarily covers. They're like, we have songs for you to do.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah, the line between, covers and originals was a little bit blurry then.
Yeah.
So.
But,
did you know that Superstition by, for pity's sakes, think of his name.
Stevie Wonder?
Stevie Wonder, yeah. I mean, he wrote the song, but that wasn't the original version.
What was the original version?
The original version was the version on a... Beck Bogart and a Peace album, which is Carmen a Peace and Tim Bogart from Vanilla Fudge with Jeff Beck.
Mm-hmm.
So they put out an album, and on the album they put out a song called Satisfaction, and that was actually written by Stevie Wonder for that album.
Really?
Yep.
What, Satisfaction or yeah. Superstition?
Superstition, sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, that it was written for that album, and that was a year before he decided to put on his own album.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yep.
That happens a lot, too. I know the song Blinded by the Light, which was, I think Manfred Mann's Earth Band had the big hit with it, but people don't know that that was written by Bruce Springsteen. And it's funny, whenever I bring that up and I tell people that, it's like, really? They have no idea, because it doesn't... His version is very different, but yeah, that happens a lot when the bigger hit... Or I guess Stevie Wonder had the bigger hit with Superstition.
He did have the bigger hit with Superstition, but again, the original version that he wrote for Beck Bogart and a Peace, it was... Well, the album was... I mean, other than like hardcore Jeff Beck fans and other like, you know, music, rock and roll, you know, people who really dug into that scene of and the music, the album was largely ignored by the general public. But Stevie Wonder said, well, that song is too good to be left there, so I'm putting it on my own album. And of course, it's one of his biggest songs ever.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say something, but, I'm going to save it for when we do that album.
Okay.
We'll save it for that.
Sure.
Next up is, this is the last track, is called, Ain't No Way.
For me to love you, if you want.
I loved the horn arrangements on that.
Mm-hmm.
That was really well done.
Yeah, again, it's a great way to wrap up an album. It's, sort of brings, you know, there's lots of, like, really energetic points and there's slower points, but it's nice to sort of bring it down at the end of that and it just sort of, like, wraps it up.
Just kind of taper it off and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this song clearly is a breakup song. And I'm just thinking, and I was wondering, how many times this song has been played at a wedding and the people didn't realize or didn't listen to the lyrics?
Yeah, it's classic. Classic. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
People don't listen to things like that. They just don't.
No. I know there's... the song by The Police, Every Breath You Take.
Yeah, that's a classic.
That's a song written from the perspective of a stalker.
Yep. Absolutely. And it's a classic, quintessential wedding first dance song. It probably gets played more for first dance than any other song. And it's completely inappropriate for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. That happens all the time. And I'm sure these aren't the only songs that happens with, cause there's a lot of songs that they sound like love songs, but they're completely the opposite, like a breakup song or something else or whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That was a very cool way to end the album. And I don't know. I really like this album, and I appreciate it, I think, more than I thought I would.
No. I was, when it came up, I'm thinking, oh, good, it's a good excuse to listen to some soul stuff around here. And I don't know why I don't get around to listening to a lot of it, and I know I should because I love it.
Mm-hmm.
There really, it needs to be in my mix of... it needs to be in my rotation a lot more than it is.
Yeah.
And somehow it just doesn't get there. I don't know why. I need to change that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole world of
absolutely
soul stuff. I mean, not just the Motown and the Stax.
I've always
stuff.
Loved Wilson. Yeah, I know. I've always loved Wilson Pickett and stuff like that.
Yeah. But yeah, Sam and Dave.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this I feel the same way. It's like I need to listen to this more.
Rufus Thomas.
Rufus Thomas. Yeah.
I have a few records of. I got one of Rufus Thomas. I'm pretty sure. So yeah.
You need more.
I need more. I need more of this stuff. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I need to work on that.
Yeah. There's got to be a compilation or something out there of
there's stuff that
you can
definitely
introduce yourself to.
I actually did buy a Wilson Pickett album, but there was no record in it. And that was annoying. I found it at Value Village, and it was just, I go through the records at Value Village. It's such a crapshoot.
Yeah.
I have better luck with the singles, believe it or not.
Yeah.
The 45s. I find some gems on those. The records, it's, I don't know. It was just the sleeve. And then there was another one. I forget. No, there's something else stuck in the sleeve, but it was completely the wrong thing.
Oh.
It wasn't him or anything. There was also an empty sleeve of Jefferson Airplane, Surrealistic Pillow there, which I really wish there was an album in there, but no. Same day, too. It was just, somebody's not paying attention to this stuff. It just drives me crazy. Anyway, that's just my little rant for.
Yeah. So, I guess the verdict is we need to listen to more soul music.
Yes, we do.
Anyway, that's I've enjoyed this album. I guess if there's anything else you want to say?
No, I think we wrapped it up pretty well. Listen to more soul music.
Yes, definitely. Everybody should.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, if that's everything, I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
And take it easy.
You have been listening to Polyphonic Press. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Polyphonic Press. Check out the website, polyphonicpress.com. Feel free to drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And finally, you can support the show by heading over to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.